This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 18th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 289 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, Risk, what is it good for? Author Polly Morland is here to paint a portrait of our everyday exposure to risk, from a forensic engineer to a ballet dancer to families living on Mount Vesuvius.
Then 50 exhibitions across 50 weeks, that's the mission of a new project this year at London's ICA. The project's curator will be here to tell us why she wants to keep it spontaneous.
And later in the show, renowned British academic and journalist John Sutherland is here to explain his journey with alcoholism, recounted in a new edition of his memoir, Last Drink to LA.
All that, plus our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda during the week to come. That's all here on the Monocle Weekly, right here on Monocle 24. I can't wait to hear about the people that live on Mount Vesuvius. What? I mean, we're being specific because they do. The people in Polly Morland's book do live on Mount Vesuvius. But let's just be general for a minute, Andrew. And what sort of geographical feature is Mount Vesuvius?
Okay, we're going to give away some of the magic here. That we run through the menu, as we call it, at the top of the show. It's taking me like six goes because I couldn't say the word volcano.
Well, you've done it now.
That's fine.
It's easy when there's no music playing in the background, isn't it? Racing you on to the next bit of the sentence.
It gets tough. On the slopes of a volcano. It's fine now, but and in the moment, I couldn't do it.
Volcano.
Volcano. Coming out as a volcano.
It's good. It's good. And the Oscar goes to Rafe Fiennes.
Okay.
It's all right.
So that's not a very good start. I'm going to warm up.
By the time we got to the end of the menu, it was edition 296 of the Monocle Weekly. It's basically mid-May. How's spring been? How's the week been? It's been a grower.
Yeah, it has
not
been
a shower.
I think everyone's come back in a storming good mood for the new year. And then I had a couple of days up in the mountains with a few of our team, talking 2015. And then I've just had a
is it easy to brainstorm wearing salopettes and a pair of thermal leggings?
That's all good. Then back to London, and then this evening I will be in Milan for the our party that we do for the menswear shows in Milan. So that's not bad, eh?
It's all right.
That's pretty good week.
It's all going okay. Are you going to take a turn on the catwalk? Are you going to be...
No.
Have you got that mastered? Then?
No. People who know Monocle 24 and our team of characters, we have a gentleman who works for us called Josh Fennett.
Yeah.
He got some new shoes this week. He's a large gentleman, about the size of a rugby player. He went asunder in his slidey shoes. It wasn't. It was a good sight. It entertained me anyway.
Is that like what happens when you put a filing cabinet on skis?
Yes. The building shook. Everyone thought it was like an earthquake going on, but no, it was just Josh's buttocks hitting concrete.
I wonder if there'll be anything as Vesuvius-like in Tom Edwards' news look ahead. It says in the script, you won't want to miss it. So let's see.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much. Oh, we did promise that one wouldn't come back, but it's back. It's back to haunt you. I'm sorry about that.
Unbelievable. It's believable. That's what it is.
It's unbelievable.
Exactly.
What's going to happen this week, Tom?
Where should we start? With the sublime or the ridiculous?
Why don't you not tell us, and then we decide which
one
it was.
Okay, you decide where this is. Now, I've got some proper news and then some stupid things. On Tuesday, a couple of days' time, it's the State of the Union in the US. I always think that's rather interesting because, especially, you know, a president in their second term, you know, what's he going to try and say to people, Barack Obama? Everyone's lost interest, really.
Are they the rower or the cox?
What does that mean?
Well, I just wanted there to be a really big silence. It's magic. Radio magic. Are they merely calling? Are they calling the orders, or are they doing all the hard work?
Oh, this is it. I see what you're saying.
Oh,
that's good. That was too intelligent for
me. I wasn't
me.
Just saying the word cocks, just because I well, could get away
so
with
immediately
it.
That's what I thought. that was too intelligent. Well, no, this is the point. And we'll find out all on Tuesday. Yeah. The day after that, Wednesday, at World Economic Forum. begins in Davos, of course, Switzerland.
Is that ridiculous?
Could be. Shall I tell you this year's theme? Yeah. It's the new global context.
Right.
Is that how you have to dress?
I don't know.
That sounds like...
Do you see what I mean? I don't really know. It's just going to explore pressing global challenges.
New global context. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what isn't included in that? I don't know. But anyway, nonetheless.
It sounds like the sort of like the title of a really, really boring and worthy art biennale in somewhere like, yeah. I don't know.
We will have good coverage of the event.
Exactly.
Okay. Every one of our live programmes, no less, Rob. But, you know, you'd have to tune in if you don't want to.
No, I'll be there.
Okay, so let's continue. I thought I'd give you a word of caution about tomorrow.
Okay.
You know, it's Blue Monday tomorrow.
Is it?
It's one of these constructs. It's probably nonsense, but it's supposedly the year's most depressing day. So I thought I'd flag that up.
And there's something to do with the level of light in the sky when you wake up in the morning, the earliness of the thing, and the amount of time you've been back at work, right?
Yeah, whether failed New Year's resolutions, I don't know if this applies for you, Rob, Christmas debts, and all these other things. That's before you even get into, the long nights in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The nights drawing in. Okay.
So, but look on the bright side. Just battle through it.
What are you going to do what do you think you can do? A kind of... a decent bottle of wine and a semi-pornographic movie. What do you? How are you going to battle?
That works
the blues?
For me. Okay. Most sort of weekday mornings. You know what I mean,
I've seen you in that meeting room.
Exactly. Well, you got to enjoy it while you can. I say find distractions.
Okay.
One of which I've got for you in the shape of today's. It's probably just got underway, but it's ongoing presently. That's right, Rob. It's the Camel Wrestling World Championship.
where is
I'm
this?
I'm not making this
taking
up.
Place?
So this is taking up
Camel Wrestling
in Turkey.
Okay.
Two camels together.
They wrestle each other.
Yeah. So you get a female camel on heat. She just stands nearby. Then in the main combat area, the two males are loosed upon one another, and they will battle to win the female. 1,200 bred for the competition. Do you want to hear about how they can win the bout?
They can kill each other. I bet this is one of these stories that hasn't got a happy ending.
No, so there's three ways to win
for either of the gentlemen.
So you have to force the other camel to fall.
Okay.
If he tumbles, he loses.
Okay.
If he retreats, even, it's game over. Or, Andrew, if he screams, make the other camel scream, the battle is over.
Why don't we?
Screaming camel.
We should enter Josh Fennett in his new shoes.
Well, he'd slip straight over, wouldn't he?
Can I just get a further word of caution? The actual wrestling can be somewhat underwhelming if you're not familiar with the intricacies.
Okay. Okay, it's one of those ones.
However, it does say it keeps it interesting because onlookers sometimes have to flee from an oncoming camel that's retreating in fear.
Where do they? What sort of size is the arena in which this is?
I don't have the specific dimensions.
I just wonder whether it's a big deal if it's on. You know, it's
on. It's probably quite sort of close quarters fighting.
Can you imagine making the big leotards for them to wear as well? that must take hours.
The cape that one of them's wearing. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's pretty exciting. Yeah. Anyway, okay. I'm going to go and watch that on Satellite Sports Channel in a moment.
I was going to say, that sounds amazing. Sounds like yet another niche Sky Sports Channel.
Absolutely. I've got a couple more for you.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for these?
Yeah.
Tuesday, this is a bit parochial. It's national... The national
Whereas wrestling wasn't.
Well, no, but in the UK, National Fish and Chip Awards. And I only wanted to say this so I can say it takes place on Tuesday. That's it. We can move on.
Okay.
God, that was good.
That was pretty good.
That was great.
The reigning champion, Quayside in Whitby, North Yorkshire, of course. One of the great homes of British fish and chip.
Home of Dracula and fish and chips.
So will they keep their title?
Yeah.
Who knows?
No.
And that's almost... I got some other completely ridiculous things, but I sense that you're interested in...
No, I think that's pretty good. Vinegar on your chips?
I prefer just salt. Oh, is that?
I like both.
Oh, yeah. Really?
I like salt and...
Really?
And do you have any condiment with it? Do you, for example, have ketchup on your chips?
I'd have ketchup.
Do you have tartar sauce with your fish?
I'd have ketchup, but I'd have it available for dipping. I would not put it over
no,
the chips.
That's right. Available, but not...
I don't know. Is that a connoisseur's choice?
No,
maybe
I'd just say...
That's good.
I'd just say that's the way to do it.
One other thing. We're talking about Blue Monday. It's International Hugging Day on Wednesday. So...
See you Wednesday.
See you both then.
Should I prepare anything for this meeting?
Well, I don't know.
Should I knock on the door next time you...
Come dressed as a camel wrestler.
Okay.
in the meeting room. Because I have a strict ban on any kind of physical touching in the workplace, but I'm prepared to let that slide on Wednesday.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's firm but fair, Tom, and I think I can... We can see that through your leotard. Tom Edwards, thank you very much indeed for your news look ahead. In the course of a single day, the average person exposes themselves to severe risks of all kinds. And yet, despite this reality, few of us remain hunkered down in a bomb shelter. Well, a new book from the writer and award-winning documentary filmmaker Polly Morland explores why this is the case, why risk is embedded in the daily fabric of our lives.
The book is called Riskwise, and it paints a portrait of people who live and work with risk every day, from a ballet star to a forensic engineer. Rob and I caught up with Polly a little bit earlier.
Polly, welcome to The Monocle Weekly. It's a lovely idea for a book, this, Riskwise.
Thank you.
Did you write it because you think that we are becoming more and more risk-averse and that might be a problem?
Yes. I mean, I think I feel really powerfully, actually, that our entire relationship with risk has become calibrated to really quite a sort of neurotic base level. And so that I was very struck by a tube journey I took earlier on today, and there's a sticker on the tube that says, in an emergency, there are various instructions, but at the bottom it says in extra large font, don't take any risks.
Yes, I've seen that one.
And I feel that that's a way of thinking that's bled through the way we do everything in recent years. I suppose there are powerful and compelling reasons that has happened. They've been very strange these years since 9/11, and there's been a very elevated sense of a fear that's rippled through society. I mean, all the more so at the moment, speaking in the wake of what's gone on in Paris. But I think this climate of fear and sense of danger has created a relationship with risk that's got out of whack. And I think that some of those large macro fears that are to do with grand societal or social or global ills have kind of bled down, and so that it affects our relationship with even the smaller scale risks. So I was very interested in, but I mean, I should also say that I equally, very early on in this project, attempted to kind of imagine what a world without risk would look like, some kind of utopia of immaculate safety. And you know, I did it on a piece of paper, literally, as a little writing exercise. And, you know, and before I got halfway down the page, it was absolute nonsense. You know, a life without risk is inconceivable,
is
unimaginable,
and
nonsense.
Boring at the same time.
It's bland and then something of a nightmare, and it requires immortality, and it requires, you know, it is logically so remote, logically, emotionally, practically so remote from the experience of being human as to be nonsense. And therefore, I was interested about some of the sort of better and worse ways one might go about living with risk. And, you know, and if you're going to steer a course between really kind of neurotic hypercaution and kind of gung-ho, yahoo, off the roof with my pants on fire kind of recklessness, how do you steer a course between those, in a way, twin evils? So that's what the book's about, and that was the overriding question that drove it.
Now, if you read much of the right-wing press in any country, you'll find that the pointing finger goes at, you know, the world of lawyers who will sue us if anything goes wrong, and this notion of, you know, it starts with children, that when they go to school that they should be certainly protected from everything. Mm-hmm. And certainly when you go out the front door here, you see gaggles of kids going around in high-vis jackets, and it's an awareness of danger.
They're just making roadwork. They're doing the roadwork, so it's just getting younger and younger.
Yeah, but it's the middle of the day on a summer and they need to wear a high-vis jacket as though it's midnight. Now, what's interesting in your book, you start off with children. You go to a place in Wales where there's a programme where kids can kind of whack hammers and play with fire and jump off bits of timber, and there is an air of danger added to their life. Do you think that there is someone to blame in this very early stages for the lack of risk? Do you think that, you know, it is, you know, the right-wing press have got it right in a way, that it is an air that, you know, put one foot wrong and you'll be sued, so let's take a million precautions instead, and that deters kids from very early on, you know, from being adventurous even?
I think certainly the kind of mores around this have changed radically even since I was as a kid, and then I'm sure it's changed a great deal since my parents were kids. And I do think that is where our relationship with risk begins.
I just wonder if it's a cultural thing that we have begun to mollycoddle our kids in a way that we never used to.
I think right across the board and right throughout life, we've got a rather skewed relationship with accountability. And that I think there is an idea that if anything goes wrong, we we feel that we have to be able to identify a single individual who's to blame. And I think that there's a culture of blame that is to do with perhaps an increasingly litigious society. It is to do with a society that's got really scared and therefore is looking for safety in the shape of bodies or individuals that they can hold accountable for things. But I think from that, it has moved to a place where we feel very ambivalent about risk because I think at the same time as we live in this incredibly risk-averse society, there is it's a kind of cliche, it's health and safety gone mad. I think there's an appetite for some sort of risk out there that's as yet unsatisfied. And I think you there are various areas in society where you can see that craving for something with a bit of edge.
Well, one thing, I wanted to ask you about the socioeconomics of this, whether all classes of people are equally risk averse. It seems that people that have sort of grown up with comfort perhaps are averse to going outside their comfort zone, literally. And in terms of people trying to find risk, this isn't just sort of outward bound holidays and kind of going down the ski slope a little bit faster than someone next to you. What about the culture of, I wonder, of the city, of big business that seems to be phenomenally risk-tastic?
Yeah, well, it has been risk-tastic. Yeah. I think it has probably edged back towards the middle. I think certainly within different groups you will find different levels of acceptance of risk. And clearly because of profitability, the financial sector, because of the sheer volume of bucks to be made, was in a sense rewarded. And there is, that risk-reward, that whole nomenclature of discussing risk through the vocabulary of risk and reward comes from that sector. I would say that actually, however, there was a very interesting thing that came out of all the people, that came through really in all the interviews that I did for this book, which was that perhaps a more valuable way of looking at which risks are worth taking. So, should we
this
all...
This is risk and return, isn't it? This is whether a risk is worth taking for the payoff you're going to get for its successful conclusion.
I suppose in a sense, but I would say that it's not a purely kind of pecuniary thing. I would argue that actually the risks... I think we all take risks. We all take risks. We take more risks than we realise we do. And there are very small risks, there are very large risks, but the risks we take map onto what we value. And I think that if we can explore a relationship between risk and what we value and try and maintain that relationship between which risks are worth taking. So this is not a polemic arguing that we should all go and bungee jump tomorrow. If you only skied down steeper slopes, you would live more.
You're the only guest we've ever had on the Monocle Weekly that's been shot out of a cannon to get here, Polly.
Literally.
Yeah.
I'm still wearing the hat.
Sorry, anyway, you were saying.
And the suit.
I wanted to jump in there because, one of the other things you look at is people who live literally in the shadow of a volcano.
Yeah.
Now, this is the everyday life that unfolds, people going around there, and they know that there is a risk, but it's a parked risk and a risk. I think you say that they take an optimistic view of the potential outcome of the volcano erupting. We're talking about Vesuvius, talking about living in Naples and living right in its shadow. When you met those people, how do they deal with that notion of daily risk that is parked in a sense?
I mean, I think there's two interesting things to say about that. One is that, it's a long time since the volcano erupted. So though it's still live, though it presents as present a danger as it ever did, it last erupted in 1947. And so among the people I interviewed, there was one very elderly couple who were teenagers when it last erupted. There's a phenomenon in psychology called the availability heuristic, which is that we weight our assessment of risk toward what we can most readily recall. I offer you that our fear of terrorism in the current climate, our fear of terrorism, our perception, our risk perception is intensely informed by what we can most readily recall. So that's particularly vivid this week, for instance. However, in the case of these people living in the volcano, as the memory has receded and been tinged and dimmed with age, their sense of how the palpable danger of the volcano on which they live has also receded. So there's one element in which time has healed their perception of risk, and in a way that may not necessarily indicate that they are any safer now than they were in 1950. for instance. However, I think there's another aspect that I'd been unsure of what I was going to encounter there and how they would feel about it. But what I was really powerfully struck by when I got there was how much they loved their home. And it's a very Southern Italian, Neapolitan idea of home and your homeland and where your fathers have been and your father's fathers and your father's father's fathers. And so that very strong idea of home and family and this is our land and this is where we belong and whatever God wills, will be, also underpins their ability to live there happily and without a keen daily sense of fear. Though, interestingly, if you spend a couple of hours interviewing them about it, there's no doubt that their brows furrow and they say, I try not to think about it too much. If I start thinking about it, I really do begin to worry, but it's our home. So there's this real tension amongst the people that live there between that idea of what they value, home and family and roots, and a sense that God really will decide. It's a very religious part of
it. What about that? How does faith come into it? Because presumably, I guess people are more risk happy if they have faith as a backup plan. Whereas if we believe that we're alone and that we have our 4 score years and 10 and then that's it, then we become risk averse.
Well, also, I think there's an idea about human agency. So if it is all determined by a divine power, you know, if that element of uncertainty that runs through all our lives is governed by providence and not by our own deeds, acts, intentions and behaviours,
then you can kind of do whatever you want.
Yeah. And I think as we've become an increasingly secular society, I also think there's been a real push towards this, well, this is my decision. There is no what will be, you know, if I play this wrong, my agency will have brought around the wrong result. But I do think there's another way of looking at that human agency is a very powerful reason to take risks, because then you can be the author of your own life. So I think it there are two sides to it.
What happens when risk goes too far? You know, because you know, we often see people who are, you know, they're addicted to risk. You know, and Rob's talking about that in the financial world. But you know, you see people in all sorts of realms of their life, whether it's sport or whether it's what their activities. Now, you look at people who are ballet dancers. You look at people who are in aviation, people who are doing all sorts of extraordinary things. You haven't really looked at the in extremis. I realise that, but. Did you
quite deliberately?
Yeah, quite deliberately. Mm. But did you feel that even for these people who are living in a way reasonably ordinary lives that involved an element of risk that they embrace, that they had a kind of a, you know, a natural barrier when they knew that things were too dangerous or too risky? For example, when you spoke to the dancer, was there things that they understood that their body couldn't do? Or
Absolutely. The dancer is a very interesting example. So she said there is a point upon which, you know, to dance beautifully, you have to push your body to its very limits. Knowing exactly where the line is, where you've pushed too far, is very difficult to work out, and it moves and it changes, and sometimes you get it wrong and you get injured. So, but I think she'd said that, I think her core point was that, you know, you must always be looking for where the limit is. And I think there are people in the book who push far closer to the limits than others. But I think they all thought about it intelligently. There was not a gung-ho individual among them, actually. It was an incredibly considered process in very different ways, but very considered process amongst all of them. Even the kids leaping off those kind of stacks of wood with a bit of rope and a petrol can and a box of matches, even they were, you know, remarkably articulate on the subject of how they made the decisions about what to do, which particular rickety heap of wooden pallets to jump off, and so on. So as much as anything, you know, yes, it's a book about risk, but it's also a book about how we make decisions around risk.
It's time to put the crash helmet on and get back in the canon
now,
Polly.
Oh, it is.
The book is Riskwise. The author is Polly Moreland. Thank you very much for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Polly. Polly Moreland there. And Riskwise is published on the 5th of February. Time for a song now, and this is a piece of new music from a very talented new young individual called Benjamin Clementine. This is Cornerstone. And that was Cornerstone New from Benjamin Clementine. He's got a record out in March. Keep your eyes and your ears peeled for that.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
50 exhibitions in 50 weeks. That's the ambitious mission of our next guest today, the independent curator Fatosh Ustek. Fatosh is overseeing a new project at the Institute of Contemporary Arts here in London. It's called Fig 2, and the aim is to showcase a new artist each week, with the following week's artist announced each Wednesday.
So what sorts of logistics and planning are involved with such a super project, and what can we look forward to in 2015? Fatosh joins us here in the studio. Welcome. As we were just saying, a huge undertaking. Most people kind of fall on their knees after they've set up one exhibition. The idea of setting up 50. Why did you feel this was actually something wise to do and something that was doable even?
It's not my idea. This idea was initiated and developed by Mark Francis and Jay Jopling in the year 2000, which it took place. Actually, they started in 99, and then it was very fast-paced. And Mark Francis's curating resulted in allowing emerging and young artists with established artists to find a platform to show a single work for the duration of a week. So 15 years later, this project is revived, and ICA is actually hosting it rather than it's part of its program. So it's an independently curated program. I'm very much excited about the legacy of this project. You know, if you would recall, like, let's say, Münster Sculpture Projects, which happens every 10 years, which traces the change, not only within the cultural landscape of Germany, but actually the whole world. So I'm very much interested in what happens with London when you actually resize a project that has happened 15 years ago, you know, more than a decade, which actually includes two different generations that has been through. And of course, the whole cultural and artistic landscape has shifted.
And there was a lot of richness back then. It first happened in 2000, was it 1999 or 2000? Or it was across those 2 years, I guess.
Yeah, it started in 2000 January, yeah. Like the first Monday of January. Yeah.
Okay,
January.
On the ball. I think that show opened and closed with Richard Hamilton. Week-long Richard Hamilton shows. That's a nice thing to bookend it. But I don't know whether they knew what they were doing for the rest of the time in between. How many pages of your diary this year are filled up with knowing exactly what you're going to be doing, Fatosh?
I am happy to say that it's like half of it is kind of
okay.
There. Yeah, it's like I have invited, but the thing is that I'm very ambitious in like making new commissions, because I'm very much excited also to treat the space or platform or ground or location or the possibility of Fig 2 as a ground for experimentation and exploration of ideas from different positions and practices. So half of it is there, but that half that is there is actually new commissions mostly. So it's going to be, again, it's like something I know and I don't know.
Is it a little bit like being a magazine editor in a way that you have the, you know, you of course you have a few regulars that you've kind of, or things that you know you've got in the book, but you have space to respond to things that are happening in the world and to do some very immediate commissions as well?
Exactly.
And there's a nice idea of the speed of it, as you said. You've got these you can act fast on things that are happening in the world. I wondered. I know that this it's at the ICA. It's a non-commercial space and all the rest of it. But is there a bit of the commercial reality or the niceness of the commercial realm creeping in there that we think that perhaps everyone that might buy something or that's interested in something will see it Before it opens, or on the night, the private view night, and that maybe everybody that should see something probably sees it within that first week, and then you can move on to the next thing. Is there an element of that to this show?
There isn't an element of commerciality in the show, but of course FIC 2 is a privately funded project. So Outset has made the possibilities, or made it possible to realize FIC 2 by creating the funds and putting the funds together. So they've also initiated new supporters such as Bista Village, which is a value retail company, and also Philips Auction House. But also we have individual FIC 2 patrons who have supported weekly or daily programming of the costs of FIC 2. So there is a private endeavor involved in FIC 2, but there is an independency. The fact that I am literally unbounded to any sort of, let's say, programming necessities from the side of ICA or any of the individual or corporate patrons or supporters of FIC 2.
And Fashish, who's the kind of first up in the show then?
It was Laura Eldred, which we started and closed last week.
And this week?
It's Charles Avery.
And what's Charles showing?
Charles is showing something that hasn't been shown in London before. So it's a 16mm projection, and it's a composite of a sculpture and an installation. And this was shown in France and in Netherlands before, and it's a piece from 2010. So one of the desires that Charles wanted to do when he was invited to do a project at FIC 2 was like, okay, I want to show this piece because it's really very significant in his practice, in his body of work, but it is not known. So for week three, we are having Hiraki Sawa. He's a Japanese artist based in London. Again, more than like 17 years, I think. He studied his BA and MA here. And what we are showing is, again, something not shown in London before. It's an installation, a two-part installation from 2012 and 2013.
And I guess you've got this week-long kind of rolling program. It's a nice place where people don't get the chance to be bored, I suppose, and things. Well, it's a fact, isn't it? It's a fact of life as a curator. You know what are hits and what are misses, I suppose. But I wondered whether, you know, how much you think the scene has changed in the 15 years since the last exhibition. I guess you're having big names, you're having people that are probably just out of art college, and you can sort of gauge everybody just the same. What do you see as the key things that have changed, say, the London art scene, where the ICA, after all, sits in the 15 years since since Figure One happened?
I think it's a very long question, or like it's a question that actually
necessitates
a very long answer. Sorry,
good interviewers ask short questions. So I wonder what's changed. I mean, there's maybe things like the advent of Frieze, for example, has the Frieze Art Fair have changed things a lot and have put different things in front of people's eyes.
Yeah, I mean, like when we talk about 2000, we're talking about, let's say, the pre-date of Tate Modern even opening. And now Tate has a very weighty presence. And the whole, let's say, international artistic scene, let alone cultural scene. And then we also have more than dozens of galleries, which are very prominent, and they're doing very good programs, introducing, let's say, artists from UK, but let alone from other countries in abroad. It could be from South America to Ecuador or to Korea. And so what's happening is like there's this kind of confluence of cultures that are becoming more and more visible in what is being produced today as an image of art. So it is a very different scene. And also, like, I feel like there's more motion in place and more flux of people from conferences and academic researchers to artists coming in for residencies or for, let's say, experimentation of ideas or collaborations with artists who are based here. So it is a very, very different picture that we are looking at from what is there in 2000.
And it sounds from the list of different things that you just mentioned there, from curators to people travelling through to artists working in all sorts of different media, this is something that you're going to sort of celebrate or put on over this year at the ICA, I suppose, the fact that you can put a video artist or participatory art next to someone doing quite traditional painting and everyone gets a fair crack of the whip. Is that sort of part and parcel of your curatorial ideas?
It is, but also I'm very much interested in this kind of notion of transdisciplinarity. So because we are influenced by not a single channel of information or source, you know, like what happens with quantum physics and what happens in the world of neuroscience.
You've got a science background.
Yeah, I have a maths background, yes. So I'm very much interested in the kind of like the bringing in or like, let's say, embracing the fact that the world around us has components from various different disciplines. So I want to embark upon this fact in a way in which, you know, art, of course, resources its body of influence from within the art, but also from outside. And how do we produce that, you know, in the form of an exhibition? How can we bring in the fact that an artwork is a body that is a composite of a literature that the artists have read and the music that the bus driver was listening when, you know, he was traveling? And, you know, so it's all about like actually elaborating the world around us and not only single-mindedly focusing on what is art and what's happening in the art today. It's about like what's happening today around us and how can we actually bring it into an elaboration of a visual, oral, sensorial experience as an exhibition.
I'm wondering whether these are fresh commissions for your show or whether people are bringing things that have been on show before, or whether the idea is all about freshness.
It is a bit freshness. I mean, it's ambitious on that level as well, like the new, what is new, what's happening. And so in a way that, like, in some interviews I already answered that, it's like, if there's an artist who's having a solo show in March, and if I was thinking about that person for June, then I wouldn't necessarily repeat that, unless it is really a different form of production or another collaborative project, then it is possible. But I will try not to repeat what is already being produced in London.
Okay, thank you, Fatosh. That was Fatosh Ustek. We'll have to have you back in at least a few months' time to see if you're still as bright and breezy and perky about 50 shows in 50 weeks. Fatosh was or is the curator of Fig 2, and that's on now at the ICA.
After the break, a frank meditation on alcoholism from the writer and literary critic John Sutherland. Stay tuned.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savour traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender travelling the world in search of new and exciting flavours, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Our next guest is the rather prolific author, academic and journalist John Sutherland. John is the author of almost 20 books, one of which, The Story of a Victorian Elephant Sensation, we featured on Monocle 24. Yet another book of John stands up for its sheer raw honesty. Last Drink to LA is half memoir, half meditation, a look back when he hit rock bottom and the alcoholism that almost destroyed him.
Last Drink to LA was first published in 2001, and a new paperback edition is out this month from Short Books. John joins us in the studio, along with his son Jack, who features in the book and also has his own book about to come out too. Now, John, we said there that it is a meditation, and you make clear at the very beginning of this book that you don't want this to be seen as some temperance tale or kind of, you know, a how I beat the demon drink. But there is a kind of a sense of victory that slowly unfolds in the book. You know, you do battle with something that you in the end win against.
I'm what in AA is called an old timer, which means I probably got more than 3 or 4 years sober. In fact, when I wrote this book in 2001 or published it, I got some 17 or 18 years. So I was a very old timer. But I'm now at a stage of life almost, you know, when you start thinking of final confessions. And I added an epilogue to this reissue, which Short Books have done. AA is a fellowship which is based on storytelling, sharing, they call it. There's no crosstalk, there's no dialogue, there's no debate in an AA, NA, LBGT meeting. What you do is you actually, and it's very wonderful in some ways because people do tell very good stories, you actually sort of recall and narrativize your drinking and your recovery and sometimes, you know, what's recently been happening to you. I found that really worked for me. So the book, which you've described very kindly, it's partly a what you might call a testament, you know, not quite a last will and testament, but it's a story of me. But it's also, I think, a tribute to the organization which saved me.
I think we should perhaps at this point introduce your son, who you've brought with you, Jack. And we should point out Jack is not a young man, but he's an adult himself who has a tale to tell as well. But perhaps you could, by way of introduction, there's a piece in your book I know that you wanted to read, which is an introduction to your son as well.
The book is called Last Drink to LA, and that's because Los Angeles is where I got sober. Of course, it's an allusion to the Nicolas Cage film, Last Drink to Las Vegas. But anyway, Jack, I got sober there, and then Jack and his mother came out, you know, when they were certain that I wasn't going to fall off the wagon again, or at least they were taking a chance that I wouldn't, to join me. I'll move into the narrative of the book. Jack arrived in Southern California to join me after I straightened out in 1983. He was then 9. By the age of 14, he had a bottle of vodka stashed in his school locker and was using any number of substances. Fondly, his parents knew nothing of this. They were suspicious. There were empty sachets in trouser pockets tossed in the wash, and the usual array of signs. Red eyes, inflamed lips and nostrils, poor grades, small sums of money regularly disappearing, and sometimes larger sums. A taste for thunderous and repetitious heavy metal. I still hate the sound of Led Zeppelin. But we didn't see anything too sinister. Hell, he was only a teenager. And if he was dabbling, that was a routine part of the Californian educational syllabus. Then, of course, the inevitable thing. He attempted suicide. It was a well-planned attempt. By hanging, not firearm, thank God. Self-destruction is, one discovered, the major cause of death among Californians under the age of 16, when they can take to the road, racing like lemmings to the cliff. He left, or intended to leave, a heart-wrenching note, saying that he confidently expected a happy reunion in the hereafter. But the things on earth were, currently, unbearable. He had touched bottom, age 15, and wanted out. It was drink and drugs that did it, this and the usual adolescent sexual confusion.
I don't want to come over all Lady Bracknell, but it seems to almost lose one Sutherland. You know what I'm going to say? To lose two might be seen as carelessness. Jack, I mean, it's a bit of a searing part of the book, that beautifully read by your dad there. Did you, not necessarily on the drink front, on following his footsteps, but in terms of writing the book, did you feel that was a cathartic testament moment for you?
I remember at a very early age being well aware, I mean, extremely young age, that my father was a quite horrific drunk, if I'm honest. And I remember at a young age saying that I would never touch alcohol and I would never go down that path. And I definitely don't think that I aspired at an older age to go down that road. You know, my belief on addiction is very simple. I believe that you either are an addict or you're not. I believe people can go through addictive phases in their life where they become dependent on a drug or a substance or something to cope with a certain time in their life. But I believe an addict, you either are or you're not. And if I look at my life from early age to now, I can see where I've been addicted to various things throughout my life, from getting in trouble as a child through sex addiction, through drugs and alcohol, through driving excessively to get an adrenaline rush, to a career, back to sex addiction, back through drugs and alcohol. And I can see throughout my entire life, and I'm now coming up to 41 this month, it's been a prolific kind of road for me. And it's taken me this long to realize that I am an addict. At the end of the day, you know, And I need to accept that. And as long as I accept on a daily basis for me that I am an addict, I'm able to live my life today not being affected in active addiction, if that makes sense.
Jack, in your dad's book, he says he's been lucky to live in a time when both booze and prose were in ample supply. And it's interesting that both of you sit here on the safer side of the fence now. Do you feel that prose stepped in to save you both in a way?
For me, there's been two primary reasons that I've wanted to do this book. I mean, first of all, I must say that, you know, I did first get sober at the age of 14, you know, being sent to a drug rehab, and then had 13 or 14 years of continued sobriety, at which point I relapsed, and then had 11 or 12 years of on again, off again, trying to get off the drugs and the alcohol, and was very unsuccessful. And I'm now at a stage where, you know, I've just hit 18 months clean and sober off all drugs and on all alcohol. And for me, this book, my book, has been wanting to let other people know that there is an option, that if they are struggling with addiction of any sort, whether it's gambling or sex or drugs or alcohol, that they don't have to live in the madness, in the insanity, that there is another way to live your life. And for me, although it's very early days for me, 18 months, I've never been happier. This is by far the happiest I've ever been in my life. And it's very simple, because I'm not abusing drugs and alcohol, and I'm living presently today, and I'm dealing with my life on a daily basis.
And that's the day-by-day thing, isn't it? I guess that's that's the thing.
I'm a little bit kind of sort of fed up with AA mottos, you know, a day at a time, let go, let God. Kind of the
you can rewrite them.
But nonetheless, like most proverbs, they have a kernel of truth. It's an illness which you have it in your own power to cure. It's very wonderful. I mean, I'm classified by the National Health Service as a person with cancer, and I shall be till I die. Like alcoholism, you're never free of it. You know, you're always recovering from cancer if you've ever had it. In fact, I am in what looks like long-term remission, thank God. But with alcohol, it's not like cancer. You don't need surgeons. You don't need heavy-duty drugs. You can actually do it yourself with help, and AA is one of those instruments which can help you. NA in Jack's case.
John, can I ask you another question, which is, you know, that we should point out actually that the book is, we're talking quite grim terms here, the book is quite funny as well.
And it's sobering, but there's a lot of long, tall stories.
Yeah, one of the stories you were talking about, how revealing you've been to each other. This book was, as you said, first written in 2001. There's a scene where you realise that the closest place you can get a drink is the local gay bar, Nardi's. And then you kind of wake up one morning and you realise you're in bed with a gentleman, but a gentleman who seems to have lost his todger, as it were, because you think he's probably pre-op or post-op.
We were woken up by his probation officer to make sure that he was at home. I mean, for a professor of some standing in his profession, that was a low moment, I have to say.
Which point you are today, Lord as well. So but is that, you know, is that putting in a story like that? Now, you could have easily airbrushed that bit out, but did you realise that this is kind of, there is some kind of black humour, as it were, in this instance?
It's not just black humour. You've got to have a reason for people to turn pages. And I've discovered, incidentally, one of the nice things about this book for me, and I'm sure one of the good things that will come out of Jack's book, is that a number of people have written to say how much it's helped them. And very movingly sometimes. And there have been lots of requests for, you know, for copies, which people don't think you'd want to buy books. Mm. But the other thing is, I've discovered that the passage you mentioned about waking up in what can only be called a squalid place, and then this awful discovery about missing things, that is what everyone remembers. Ian Rankin on that Newsnight Review. Oh, do you remember that bit where wakes up and the guy hasn't got a penis? Oh, God, thank you, Ian. Thank you, thank you.
Yeah. Well, maybe the gentleman will come out of the woodwork and ask for a
penis. I think libel suits are not... he's going to have... Jack's going to have a plate full of libel suits.
That's the real reason he can't afford to live in America. John and Jack Sutherland, thank you both very much for joining us. The books are Last Drink to LA, published by Short Books. That's by John Sutherland, and Stars, Cars and Crystal Meth by his son Jack. And that's out, published by Faber. When's that out?
July, I think.
That's out in July. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
And there we have it, Andrew. That was edition 289 of the Monocle Weekly.
Full of danger, full of risk, but we somehow battled it through. I embraced that danger.
Yeah, exactly. We've had a drink.
We haven't had a drink.
We haven't had a drink.
But
we have delved into the darker recesses of it.
And that was quite a
moment, wasn't it? It's one of those. It's kind of wonderful when you're in a radio studio. And there was a bit of a moment, and between John and his son, that there was a moment, wasn't there? And it was quite an amazing thing.
Yeah, well, as everyone will have just heard, that moment where he says you get to know each, when they're talking about their father-son relationship, I think we both looked at each other. There's an understanding that yes, they got to know each other in a way that a parent and son normally don't, but not quite sure how they felt about it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's a bit of a remove there. Let us thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and Marcus Hippie, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here at the same time next week, but for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.